morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us this morning. Our guest today is Pima County Attorney Chief Criminal Deputy Jonathan Mosher. Did I get that right?
You did, Sherry. Good morning. Thanks for having me. With one caveat, which is that I'm on a leave of absence from that position to run for office.
There you go. And why do they make you do that?
Well, I don't know why they make you do it, but I would answer it a different way, which is that the campaign, it really demands full-time attention. It's a countywide campaign. It's for the Office of County Attorney, which is the lead prosecutor, and it's such an important position. It demands full-time attention to do this campaign. It is, frankly, a seven-day-a-week, all-day-long, everyday job. So I think it's best for the citizens of the county that they have somebody in the chief criminal deputy position who's focused 100% of their time on that task, and I need to be focused on the campaign to succeed Barbara LaWall as county attorney.
And she's endorsed you, hasn't she?
She sure has. Yeah, I'm really proud of that and grateful to Barbara for her 24 years of service as Pima County attorney. She's been a leader.
She's done some amazing things.
She's opened the door for women in this county, setting a tremendous example. She's been a tireless advocate for victims' rights. And dating back to before we even had victim rights as part of the Constitution of the state of Arizona. And we've been a leader in this field. You know, there are a lot of places where we're lagging behind, including in education. But in victim rights, we've always been a leader. And a big part of that goes to Barbara LaWall. So I'm proud to have worked for her. I think she's been visionary for her time. And I look forward to being visionary for my time.
Okay, what would be like the first thing you would do if you're elected? Very first thing you would want to do at the office?
I think a lot of people, when they ask that question, may be asking about what I would change, but I want to make sure, because we're talking about the lead prosecutor position, that I just have to first and foremost say the things that I am going to make sure we continue to prioritize, and that is protecting our community from domestic violence, gun violence, sexual assault, child abuse, and molestation. Those are things we do very well at the county attorney's office, and we need to continue to do them very well, and I am the best qualified candidate in order to do that, which I can explain later. But that really wasn't your question. I think your question goes to, but what would I change? And I mean, there are a great many things that I think we can grow, improve, and even do differently. On my short list of tasks is to end what I believe to be kind of a charade as far as how we treat personal possession of marijuana. And however you feel about marijuana, what you need to know is currently people can go get a medical marijuana card and possess it legally. And that means those people who can't afford the card are literally committing a crime, and we're opening up files on that in our office. Now, Barbara has been progressive insofar as personal possession less than 2 pounds is waived to a misdemeanor, and 2 pounds is a heck of a lot. So she's been progressive compared to other parts of the state, certainly on marijuana, and I don't want to suggest otherwise, but I'm going to double down on that, take that further. I don't want to be prosecuting those offenses. And so I don't want to be spending time opening up files, going to court and trying to seek some type of criminal sanction on people who have been arrested with a small amount of marijuana simply because they didn't have a medical marijuana card. I'm going to immediately and drastically expand drug treatment alternatives to prison because they work. They're less expensive than prison. They're more effective. And what we all want is to be victimized less and to have people not suffering from addiction. I mean, I'm one such person. I'm 18 and a half years recovering from alcoholism and addiction. And I know what it means to not be able to stop using, even if you want to. And we need to help people get out of that situation. And every time we do, it's a win for our community.
So the first thing you're going to do is not change your office?
Well, I've got plenty of changes.
Move the corner office with the big window of the city?
You know, I've got plenty of changes. And like I said, the marijuana position is a change.
Yeah.
My position on the death penalty is a change. My drastic expansion of drug diversion and drug treatment alternatives is a change, and will result in prosecutors being able to be employed in direct attempts to address domestic violence, property crimes, you know, the ways in which people are victimized in Pima County. So those are significant changes. And there are others as well. I mean, I support a way in which people who have done their time, and let me back up for 1 second. I've been for 15 years putting people in prison who have done horrible things, sex assault, child molest, murder. And, you know, I get that a lot of people are not in those categories of offenses. So there are a lot of lower level offenses like burglary or theft where people are going to get out of prison after some time served. And those people need a way to come back into our community, join it, and be productive. And some of what we've been doing in the criminal justice system impedes that. So just by way of example, I am going to look at ways to support reentry and rehabilitation. One way to do that is automatic restoration of rights other than gun rights for dangerous offenders. And so that too would be a change. I want to make sure the system is fair and working for us, not against us. So there are aspects of the system that currently tend to disproportionately affect the poor and minorities. Let me give you one example. Money bond. There's no reason why somebody is in jail if they're poor. There's no good reason why. But money bond tends to produce that result.
Because they can't come up with it.
Right. And so why would it be, you know, for me, these issues are real. And when I say that, I've got opponents who have never prosecuted a single crime. I have an opponent who has not tried a case as a prosecutor, not one time, and wants to lead an office of 70 prosecutors. And when I talk about prosecution, it's real to me based on 15 years of experience. And when I'm talking about money bond, I tried the case against David Watson, a fire captain. We talked about it on the show before. He killed three women, got away with it for 15 years. I and my co-counsel put the case against him together, and we tried him. But I remember vividly when the judge reduced his bail from the over $1 million cash that we requested to $900,000. And, you know, that's a lot of money, but I didn't know for sure that he couldn't come up with that money. And this is a man who had killed a woman just to eliminate her as a witness. And we had serious concerns that he would do that again if he got out. What meaning does $900,000 have? What place does that have in the system at that point? That someone rich can get out and kill a witness? It makes no sense. So, sorry, I kind of digressed. But I definitely want to make it clear. I want to make it clear that I support some significant changes. But at the same time, I do respect and admire Barbara. And I want to give her credit for, again, being visionary for her time. I just think now is a new time. And I'm going to be visionary for mine. So we'll be doing a lot more than moving offices.
Now, are you going to keep the programs that she's already put in place?
Well, there are some great programs we have, you know, Kids in Court, Courthouse Dogs, 88 Crime. I mean, we have wonderful programs.
The baby. You can leave your baby at a safe place.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, what we don't need to do is burn the system down. And, you know, again, I think what you want as a lead prosecutor is first and foremost a prosecutor who has experience, you know, managing, leading, and prosecuting cases. And that's what I've got.
It seems to me there needs to be a lot more common sense put into the system, too, when you're talking about bringing people out of jail and putting them, you know, make them productive citizens. There's got to be a process to help them do that.
Absolutely. I've been meeting with, among other people, I've been meeting with reentrants, people who have been in prison and are coming back into our community. And let me just assure you that if we as a society try to label people as simply good or bad, and if you've committed a crime, you're bad and you're bad forever, then we'll reap what we sow. We'll just get more and more crime. And so what I find in talking to reentrants is a thing that I'll do that will be different, which is that I want to make sure those people are coming into my office, talking to my prosecutors, so that every prosecutor with every file they handle understands that there's a life on both sides of the equation. I mean, often there's a victim who's been harmed and we need protection of the community. And then, you know, on a lot of these offenses, like if it's a theft, I mean, there's somebody who's going to pay their time, pay their dues, and then they're going to need to come back into society and be better. So, one way to make that happen is to make sure that we're communicating with reentrants about their needs. There's a lot to be done in that area. I'm excited to do it.
I have a question. If somebody's gone to prison, they've done their time in prison, but what about restitution for the victim if it's a burglary, if it's, you know, property damage or whatever? Do they have that accountability as well?
Yeah, and so there is an outstanding example of where we can actually work against ourselves if we think that, you know, what we need to do is just really hammer this person. If we continue to hammer them and make it so that they can't get a job and get back on their feet, they can't pay the restitution.
Right.
So, you know, what we want are elements of a restorative system. Now, look, I've been first and foremost protecting the community for 15 years again. So I am not talking about, risking the lives of the folks in our community or failing to protect our kids and our vulnerable adults. What I'm talking about is making sure that when people get out of prison, they can get a job, pay taxes, and then pay their restitution. That's best for everybody.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is Jonathan Mosher. He's on leave. He works at the prosecuting office in Pima County. I want to talk about child abusers and molesters being held accountable. What is your plan for this?
Yeah, so Sherry, most recently I was chief criminal deputy responsible for running the whole criminal division. But before that I was chief trial counsel. And so I have a pretty varied experience, which is maybe unusual for a prosecutor because I have done a bunch of what we in the prosecution field call special victims unit type cases, which includes sex assault, child molest, serious child abuse. And I've been doing those type of cases for years, as well as doing vehicular homicides, gun violence cases, domestic violence cases, and quite a lot of murder and cold case prosecution. So that's a varied experience that a lot of prosecutors don't have. And what is unique, it allows me to talk about what's different about child crimes and what's important in terms of training prosecutors to be able to get after people who molest and abuse children. And I want to use one example to talk about what's different about these type of cases. I prosecuted a case involving a young man whose grandfather had molested him for years. And it started when he was a young boy, and he didn't tell his mom about it until he was about 16 years old. And what happens with a kid in a situation like that is that, sadly, and it's really heartbreaking, he'll blame himself. He'll carry the weight of shame of thinking that somehow it was his fault that he let this happen. And it can be quite complicated to present those cases to a jury because jurors will wonder, you know, why the delay in the child reporting. You know, why did he, if this happened, why didn't he tell somebody sooner? And jurors struggle with that issue until they hear from experts who are trained in this field and can explain what goes on in a child's head when this type of abuse is happening. And that can be, I don't want to take up all the time talking about it because there's different phases of this. There's something going on called grooming where a perpetrator will entice the kid with rewards and escalate the types of touching. And so what we get in these cases is we get a need for expert opinion. More than that, though, we also need specialized resources. And you asked about programs earlier, and I mentioned things like Kids in Court. Well, Kids in Court is a program where these types of victims, these young children, can come to court and figure out what it's going to be like to testify in court. We also provide trained support dogs. And this may sound like a little thing, but if you've ever seen a child's eyes light up when they come down to our office, and they're coming down to talk about the most difficult, horrific things that you could imagine happening to a kid, but they're okay with coming to the office. They're okay with going to court because we do things that provide them the support emotionally that they need. So they look forward to coming to the office, frankly, to see the dog. It's just heartwarming. It kind of brings a tear to my eye right now talking about it. And so if you've never done this work, how are you going to lead an office full of people who are doing this work? How are you going to know what programs to prioritize and ensure get the right funding and the right resources? So I've been doing this. It's real to me. I know how to expand, encourage, and promote prosecutors to do this work. And when I say that, that has a specific texture to me because I co-try these cases with other newer prosecutors and teach them how to do the work. And then I travel around the state lecturing on how to prosecute these cases. So the idea that you know, I have an opponent who has never prosecuted a single case, not one time, and wants to take over these type of efforts, it really should scare people who really want our community to be protected and want to make sure that there's somebody who's lead prosecutor who really has the experience and knowledge and training to do that.
Yeah, it's a huge thing, and there's so many facets to it. You have to be experienced in this area in order to be successful, and it's unfortunate that we even have to talk about it. What about prioritizing gun violence, domestic violence?
So with respect to gun violence and domestic violence, and by the way, you know, the numbers are bad for domestic violence. It's on the rise. And, you know, women are victimized not just by gun violence in the domestic violence setting, but also in our community by sexual assault. And again, to be able to manage and train prosecutors in these efforts, you really ought to have some experience in them. I mean, for example, I put away a serial rapist who was active in Tucson years ago. His name was Duran, and he's now doing multiple decades of prison time. But one of the issues with that case was that he had, you know, he was clever enough to select victims who, some of whom were living on the margins. And by that, I mean addicted to methamphetamine, being sex trafficked. And so one of the things that needed to happen is we need to figure out how to present the case in the strongest possible way. And there were a lot of strategic elements to doing that. And if you don't know how to do that, then how do you know how to train other prosecutors to do that? And how can you possibly promote those efforts on a management level? So fighting against sex assault, and then let's take the domestic violence setting, because there we have some significant issues with needing to have specialized training, knowledge, expertise. In domestic violence cases, what will often be left with at trial is what we in my work call a recanting victim. And what that means is now, you know, often it's not always he and she, but often, you know, it's an abused woman we're talking about. And if she has forgiven him, decided to go back to him, or been bullied or threatened into thinking that she needs to lie in court, yeah, we've got to be able to explain how and why that happens and what are the dynamics of the power and control that abusers wield over their victims. And that involves, just like I was talking about with the child victims, it involves specialized experts working with them to present their testimony, and then training young prosecutors to know how to do that work.
And how to recognize it.
How to file all the related motions. I mean, this, you know, it's really daunting, Sherry, to think about the fact that we've got to make sure Pima County voters know what they're voting for when they vote for county attorney.
That's true. That's so true. And what is this Community Justice Board?
Community Justice Board is an exciting program, and this, like you were mentioning before, Barbara's really done a lot of great things. And let me just say something about that. Other prosecution offices in the state of Arizona will come to Pima County to learn about things like diversion program, drug treatment alternatives to prison programs. Literally, I've seen prosecutors from around the country come to Tucson to study our specialized programs. Seriously, we're a national leader. One of the things that we're doing that is really outstanding is a program called Community Justice Boards, or CJB. And what it does is it educates members of the public. You literally, Sherry, could be on such a board along with other people from the community. And what you would be doing is offering a restorative justice approach, not punitive, to kids who have gotten in trouble and are in the juvenile justice system. Now, here's the thing about CJB. When we talk about what would I do differently, it's I promote and encourage CJB. It is a great program, but now it's time to take it and expand it far beyond what it's currently doing. So CJB should exist in schools so that kids don't have to get involved with the juvenile justice system before they're benefiting from a restorative approach in the school. So the best way...
You're talking high school?
Yeah. Well, high school will be the place where it has the most impact. And okay. And the... you know, what we're talking about here, just to be clear, is we're talking about preventative approaches to crime. So the best way to fight crime is to prevent it from happening in the first place. A lot like what we were talking about earlier when people re-enter society from prison, if we can make it so that they don't re-offend, we are helping ourselves as well as the person coming back into society.
Do some of the companies around town help with this type of... program as far as, because I know I used to work when my son was in school, I worked for Sam Levitt. And I know he had people with ankle monitors on their ankles delivering furniture and doing different things in the stockroom and stuff. Are there more companies in town that do stuff like this to help with the...
We have such a giving community. It makes me smile when you're saying that, because I happen to know that Sam Levitt's Furniture donated all the furniture for our what we call respite room at the courthouse so that victims have a place they can be. Sometimes I've been down there for trial this that last 2 months, and people need a place where they can be in the breaks between the trial. And so there are people who generously donate huge amount of resources to us in our varied programs. You know, by the way, about Tom and Linda Grissom,
yes,
who have built a program called New Beginnings at the Humane Society. I'm on the board of the Humane Society, and I just love this program. It takes DOC, prison inmates, and it has them work with difficult dogs that otherwise might not be adopted out of the Humane Society. And these inmates train the dogs. The dogs get adopted. The inmates get a source of light and joy in their life that might help them not reoffend.
Exactly.
Right. And, it's a great program. There's so much going on in the community. Let me just mention Umberto Lopez. He took a hotel and donated it, converted it. I mean, he owned a hotel and it has been refurbished to not just house homeless people, but to provide, like, it's an unbelievable array of services. He's literally got services for, you know, they're going to have medical services as well as drug treatment. Even health and well-being services, all being provided under one roof. It's called the Center of Opportunity. And the fact that somebody would go in that big, you know, to support our community, it just gives you hope for the future because, yeah, we're all working together from both political parties, from all walks of life, trying to solve these issues. And that's the good part of my job, you know, because the dark part of my job is just case after case. That's just brutal crimes. Yeah. And so it's so nice to see people taking steps to try to prevent crime in the first place.
And to help people who may have gone down the wrong track for a little bit, but are redeemable and bring them back.
Yeah. I mean, I'm also involved in the board of the Boys and Girls Club. And there you're talking about prevention, not rehabilitation. There you're talking about providing kids who don't have a safe place to go where there's a good impact on their life, whether it be sports, programming, role models who teach them how to paint or why they should explore college, get them scholarships. I mean, what's going on at the Boys and Girls Club is just tremendous as well.
And we used to have a program that was at the Boys and Girls Club, Real Kids Productions, and Barbara was on the show many times being interviewed by youth.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know if you know this, but now there's a woman named Cindy Robertson who's down there donating her time to teach kids to paint.
That's
and it's
awesome.
Just so cool. Yeah. And then they sell the paintings and it raises money for the Boys and Girls Club. You know, and there's, I don't want to digress too far, but the point is that is preventative. That is people, instead of just complaining about the system, that has people trying to actually prevent kids from embarking on a life of crime. And I think those programs work.
Yeah, I've seen them work. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today is Jonathan Mosher. And we're just talking about some of the major things that the prosecutor's office does. I want to talk about the death penalty. Because, in fact, I had a conversation yesterday with somebody. They're like, why don't they just... you know, put people out of their misery talking about the victim's family. And then, you know, there's no recourse. Once a person is put down, there's no bringing them back. And what if they're not guilty?
Yeah, so, you know, when we talk about the death penalty, I get frustrated by people having a view without first listening to the facts. Here are the facts. First, it's important to have experience in the criminal justice system. So I prosecute murders. I've prosecuted about 100 major felony trials, but about a couple dozen homicides. And none of them has been a death penalty case. And let me explain why that's important. I deliver a reasonable amount of justice, and by that I mean natural life in prison on a reasonable timeline. And it might shock people, but a reasonable timeline is like 1 to 2 years. Victims are horrified when they find out it takes a year or two to get a case to trial and get someone sentenced. But that's the timeline for a non-death case. Is in about a couple of years, I can get, you know, a sentence of natural life in prison. Let me explain. Let me give examples. David Watson killed 3 women, got away with it for 15 years. I put the case against him together in 2015. He was convicted in 2017. He's doing natural life in prison. What does that mean? No parole. He'll never get out. Kay Reed, we've talked about her case before. She was disabled from childhood polio. She was a 62-year-old woman. She was murdered in 2008. Her body has never been found. I put the case against her killer together in 2014, took him to trial in 2016. In 2 years, natural life sentence imposed. He'll never get out. Josh Lelevier killed his 13-year-old stepdaughter, spied on her in the bathroom. He dumped her body out in Vail where they lived. And Josh Lelevier, in less than 2 years, we got him convicted. Natural life in prison. He'll never get out. Now let's talk about death penalty cases. These cases have appeals that last literally over 20 years. We have one person on death row who's been there over 35 years. He murdered a young woman in 1980, and he is still on death row. So it's not working, folks, and it is costing millions of dollars. Now, no one's been put to death in Arizona since 2014, 6 death sentences since 2011, and untold millions, and all this torment inflicted on victim families. Why do I say that? Because, you know, this is real to me. I go to work on a Monday, and I will meet with victim family after victim family who have lost a loved one to the most brutal, horrific types of murder. And when these people get some type of justice on a reasonable timeline, you can see it help them in their lives. There is nothing more rewarding as a lawyer to take a murder case to trial, and after the verdict comes back of guilty, to look behind you in the courtroom and seeing the victim family crying. Not crying because they are sad, but crying tears of joy because they finally have some accountability for the murder of their loved one. And I can deliver that on a realistic timeline in non-death cases. And all I can deliver in death penalty cases is decades of suffering to the victim family. So it's not working, folks. And it's putting a huge drain on our resources. So we've just got to move away from it.
So if somebody is in prison for life with no possibility of parole, they don't have those appeals offered to them?
Yeah, I mean, they do have appeals, but the appeals are so much more limited that they literally can be resolved in a reasonable amount of time. The death penalty appeals, they get involved in the Ninth Circuit,
yes.
which is a federal system. And once they're there, it's just out of control. And by out of control, I mean 20, 30 years of appeals. And by the way, then what happens, and again, you got to have some knowledge and experience as a prosecutor to know what this looks like, because if they get overturned on appeal 20 or 30 years later, what do you think's happened to all the witnesses?
Yeah.
I mean, they've moved on, their memories have worsened, some of them have died. And so the case can become impossible to try again. So you can be left with a lesser sentence. And by the way, the other thing people will say to me is they'll say, well, you know, I really want to be tough on crime. So I want people sentenced to death row. And when they say it, I hear it in their voice. They think death row is like the place that inmates are most scared of. No, they're not. They're not scared of it. Death row, there was a lawsuit won in 2017. Death row inmates get to commingle with other inmates. They get time on the yard with other inmates. They get contact visits with lawyers and civilians. Death row is not a place where nobody is quivering in their shoes who is a brutal murderer. No, they're not scared of the death penalty because they understand that just gives them
more time.
20, 30 years to appeal their case. So it's even whether you take it from an angle, because increasingly in my own mind, Sherry, is that I've devoted my adult life to fighting violence. It's what I do. And it leaves me a little dry to think that what I'm doing is imposing violence to fight violence. So that's my own kind of moral journey. But you don't have to agree with me on that. You just need to know how the death penalty is actually working.
Or not working.
There is no brutal murderer in Arizona who has the remotest fear. There hasn't even been an execution since 2014. So it's not working. We need to get away from it. It's a tremendous drain on our resources. We can do a lot of good things with the millions of dollars extra that are spent on every single death penalty case.
And people don't understand. I don't think people understand the drain it has on the victim's family, having to relive and relive and relive, continually going back to court. And if you have a conversation with any of them, they're like, you know, I know he's locked up or she's locked up forever, and they're not going to ever hurt anybody else. And that's, you know, good enough.
You know, the people who I had started out with a disclaimer. I've never taken a death penalty case to trial. The person who's done the most of this work in Southern Arizona is named Rick Unclesbay. And he wrote a book recently, and it's called Arbitrary Death. And Rick's, I feel for him as a prosecutor, because you know how I said I devoted my life to fighting violence? You know, I describe those cases like the Watson or the Kay Reed or Lelevier cases where I've delivered a reasonable amount of justice in a reasonable amount of time. By reasonable, I mean natural life in prison in a couple of years. And Rick has had the experience of, it's almost like Sisyphus rolling that rock up the hill and having it come rolling back down every day, is that he worked mostly in death penalty cases. And what he has seen in case after case is the victims come to him 20 years later and say, why didn't you tell me it would be like this? I never would have supported the death penalty had I known. And you can't tell that to people, you know, in the weeks or months after their daughter or son is brutally murdered.
They're still processing.
They only realize it once it's too late. Yeah. And so it's not working.
Yeah. And the more we realize that it's not working, the better off we'll all be, especially as a society. And financially, it's not going to drain us of our resources. What about, I'm going down this list. You've got a huge list of things we should talk about. And we only have an hour. what about your civil experience? I know you've done a lot of cases, murder cases, and you've been very successful at it. And I know you've taught a lot of people. In fact, the first time I met you was after you did closing arguments for the Watts case. You came down to TPD, and we were in a class that Barbara LaWall put together, and you talked about it. You were just fresh out of the courtroom, having done closing arguments, and said, we won't know until tomorrow or later on this week. So that was my first impression of you. It was like, wow, he knows what he's doing.
And thank you, Sherry. And to be fair, I wasn't there to talk about that case. I talked about a case that had been already sentenced, but I did mention that I was in trial in the Watson case, which had received a ton of publicity at the time.
Right.
You know, and so you ask about civil experience, because it's true. For 15 years, I've been a prosecutor, going after horrible crimes. But what did I do before that? When I graduated from law school in 1994, I came to Arizona and clerked at the Arizona Supreme Court in 95, 96. And I got a little distracted from a child. I had always dreamed of being a prosecutor. I wanted to go after people who had done horrible things to other people and get after them in the courtroom. But when I clerked for the Arizona Supreme Court, I got a little sidetracked because, you know, with that position comes the ability to work at prestigious law firms. And so I went and worked at big law firms in Southern California for almost a decade. And the reason I bring that up is because people don't realize, they say, what's the difference between a DA and a county attorney? One of the things the county attorney does is we oversee a civil office, which is about 25 lawyers, give or take, which makes it, if not the largest, one of the largest law firms south of the Gila River. And so if you are the county attorney, although 75 of the lawyers you're going to be overseeing are prosecutors, or 70-ish, there's going to be 100 total, and a quarter of them are civil lawyers doing civil work. So what kind of work are we talking about? You know, representing the Department of Environmental Quality, protecting the water we drink and the air we breathe, you know, working on behalf of representation of the county and the Board of Supervisors, the ability of the county to provide employees with same-sex domestic partner benefits, or working with the Board of Supervisors to defend against attacks when they were providing funding to Planned Parenthood. I mean, our civil division does important civil work. And I'm the only candidate for this job that has nearly a decade of experience in civil practice. So when you're going to oversee, you know, 25 lawyers doing that work and important work at that, you really ought to have both prosecution experience and not just prosecution, like prosecuting cases, because one of my opponents is a 23-year prosecutor, but has not been a supervisor or management leader in the office. And so one thing you got to have is management leadership experience. Another thing you should have is civil experience. And then another thing is the prosecution expertise we've been talking about. So I'm the only candidate that has all three of those things that it takes to run the county attorney's office.
Our guest today is Jonathan Mosher. And if you have any questions for Jonathan, the number is 790-2040. And I want to talk about this drug treatment program. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so one area that I'm passionate about is making sure that we're handling addiction appropriately. And I think I mentioned earlier, you know, I'm a recovering alcoholic addict. I'm 18 and a half years sober. And if I had not gotten sober, I wouldn't be doing this work, which has been so meaningful to me. It's made all the difference in my life to be sober. I want other people to be able to attain, you know, sobriety and live clean from drug and alcohol addiction. So one thing that is really frustrating to me is to see what I believe to be not a very principled distinction in society. And now we're going to talk big picture for a second. So forgive me, Sherry, but you know, we'll lock up an alcoholic if they drive drunk and threaten other people on the roadway. But we're not going into people's homes or going to the park and plucking alcoholics. People are drinking themselves to death. We don't put them in prison. We don't say, well, you're an alcoholic, so you're just going to dry out in prison for a few years.
And that's, you know, what they call it too, dry out.
And I think people would be horrified if we did. I think most people know someone who's an alcoholic, a friend or a relative. And if they're not, other than driving drunk, you know, we leave them alone and rely on hopefully some type of societal intervention so they'll get sober, but we're not relying on prison to do it. And so that I find there to be a disconnect in that somehow we've all just accepted that what we should do with a heroin addict is lock them up in prison. And, you know, look, if a heroin addict is breaking into your home or your car, we will hold them accountable. But that's true of somebody who's stone cold sober breaking into your car or your home, or somebody who's drunk. None of those things are a get out of jail free card. But now let's talk about addiction. Because if somebody has a small amount of heroin in the park, I find it exceedingly strange that we take them to prison. Now, and I'm not saying we do that always, but that's been the philosophy, you know, over time in the criminal justice system nationally. Now, what have we been doing about that in the Pima County Attorney's Office? There has been some effort to address that. And I'm really supportive of what we've done so far. For example, we've on this show before talked about DTAP, our Drug Treatment Alternative to Prison program. It takes people who otherwise, the heroin addict from the park, who they've repeatedly offended, and there's nothing else going to happen except they're going to be sent to prison. This is a program that gives a treatment alternative. It's effective. It saves lives. It saves money. It's cheaper than prison. We get people succeeding at far higher rates without locking them up and instead providing treatment programs. Okay, so that program exists, but what's the problem with it? It's way too small, sort of by design. And the reason is because it is the last stop before you get sent to prison. Well, now what I've been working on, and I'm proud to say I'm the only candidate for county attorney who has worked to design drug treatment alternative to prison programs, period. And the one that we've been working on, now I'm on leave of absence, but when I was chief criminal deputy a couple months ago and for the months preceding that, we were working on a program which hopefully will come online this year. And it is, we call it pre-charge diversion. What does that mean? We don't even have to take somebody before the grand jury. We don't even have to open up a file in my office to get them help that they need. We can do that by having a court specially designed with treatment providers in the court, and somebody can get signed up through not a plea agreement and admission of guilt, but through a contract. And this is so exciting because when you start opening up files in my office, you are initiating a long sequence of events, which is expensive, cumbersome, and may not be that effective in addressing addiction. And so now we're going to start putting at the front end on a much larger scale what we've been doing as kind of a almost like a pilot program at the very end of the sequence. So what I want to say, because you started out by saying, well, what would you change? I will radically expand because of my philosophy is different. My philosophy is that addiction is a public health problem, not a criminal justice problem, in the right. absence of other criminal activity that threatens our society. And so I don't want to see addicts locked up. And so that's a philosophical change. And that means I will grow and expand these programs and approaches in every conceivable way that is still responsible as far as protecting the safety of our community. And you need to have both things, right? So,
and there are grants out there that have helped promote these programs as well. So it's not like, you know, we're still paying for somebody to get sober.
Well, we pay far more to lock them up in prison. And you're right. There are millions of dollars of grant funding available and that have already been obtained by our office. We're pretty proud of that. And I'll continue to double down on those efforts. So, you know, that's a great point, Sherry. You come online as a county attorney. You're the lead person in the office. And what you've got to be able to do is figure out where to go to get that money to expand these programs. And, you know, you want to be able to have experience and knowledge in doing that. And again, I'm the only candidate who's helped design one of these programs. I work with the people who help us get that grant funding. And I look forward to doing that as county attorney on a much larger scale.
And that's not the only program. The New Beginnings program was something that you helped initiate.
Well, I can't take credit for initiating New Beginnings. That was Tom and Linda Grissom. But what I can pledge to do is to look for every possible way to take programs like New Beginnings, which is the one at the Humane Society where we're having DOC inmates work with dogs. I want to expand programs that give people a light at the end of the tunnel when they get out of prison. Because folks, we're not going to lock somebody up for life for stealing a bicycle, or, you know, for breaking into a car and taking an iPod. They are going to get out of prison. And when they get out, we want them better. See, you want to be not, you don't want to be tough on the criminal so much as tough on the crime. What we want to do is we want to reduce and prevent crime. And so we've been working against ourselves to the extent that we make it so hard for people, once they've done their time, to come out and have success. And I will ease barriers to reentry. So, for example, people ought to be able to vote. They ought to be able to get a job. They ought to be able to pay taxes. Imagine, we have a whole population of people who want to do those things. They've had their freedom denied to them in prison, justifiably so. They've done their time, though. And now they want to get out and get better. Do we want to make them worse so we'll get victimized again? It's just not an intelligent way to fight crime.
So what is the program right now where people can be treated and reenter into society as a productive citizen rather than still a burglar or whatever they are?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. So if you're talking about drug treatment programs, we have an array of them. We're working on the pre-charge one I talked about, and then we also have drug diversion and drug court and DTAP. So there are some programs there. If you are talking about rehabilitation in prison, it is a pretty bad landscape right now in Arizona. 97% of inmates do not get any substance use disorder treatment, which means they get out of prison equally addicted as when they went in, which just underscores the fact that prison is not the way to treat drug addiction.
That's so true. Okay. What are the misconceptions about you?
Well, I don't really know, but who knows what people would say. The issue in my mind is, can you be a tested prosecutor with the kind of experience we've been talking about and at the same time be a committed reformer? I think that's what you'll hear said out there on the street, is you'll hear people say, well, Mosher's been working in the office, so that means he can't change a gosh darn thing. And I just, frankly, I just have no patience for that argument. You know, you have to have a tested prosecutor run the office, and you have to have somebody who's committed to expand and promote the effective reforms that we can make to be better on protecting our community. And so I think you can have both. And I think, frankly, as a voter in Pima County, you ought to demand both. You better find someone to run that office who can be innovative for this time. And I think that's me. We've been talking about that with respect to death penalty, with drug diversion, with marijuana. You know, not everyone's going to agree about all these things, but I think it's pretty obvious that I'm an innovator. And at the same time, you better have somebody who's a tested prosecutor, who's been in the courtroom fighting on behalf of victims. Again, the most rewarding part of my career has been, you know, something like working on the Lelevere case, for example, where a stepfather murders his stepdaughter, and, you know, Jaden's mom was so impacted by all this that when I first met her, she could barely speak, you know, with grief. I mean, a mother's grief is like a black hole. It has like a gravitational force to it. And I've been in rooms with mothers of murdered victims. And then to walk through the trial and to be the voice in the courtroom for a murdered child,
yeah,
and hold her killer accountable, and then watch as her mother gets some respite and gets to leave the courtroom and not have to come back for decades for appeals. That's just been...
That's huge.
Incredibly rewarding to me to be able to do that type of work. And so I hope when people vote in this primary, and they should vote, it's going to be in August. That's when the election will be. I hope that people will be educated about what the county attorney does, and they'll seek a county attorney who's got civil experience, management and leadership experience, and significant prosecution experience, because you want a tested prosecutor and you want a committed reformer.
You want everything to progress, not regress.
Absolutely.
Okay. We've got a minute left. Final word. You've got 30 seconds. Put them on the spot.
Well, I guess, you know, I just want to thank you, Sherry, but I want to thank people who are listening and the people who I've been able to serve. And the reason I say that is because I really view it as a bit of grace that has allowed me to get sober and then be able to move to Tucson and fight crime here since 2005. And it's a special line of work. There's nothing else like it for a lawyer to be able to serve people in cases of horrible crimes. And so I just want to thank the community for entrusting me with this incredible work.
Okay, I want to thank you for coming on this morning, and I want everybody to join us next week. We've got Craig Sawman Sawyer from Veterans for Child Rescue coming on. Till then, shop local, stay safe.